Cambridge English, Certificate in Advanced English, Listening. Sample Test 1. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I'll introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you'll hear this sound. You'll hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You'll have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There'll now be a pause. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You'll hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer, A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1. You hear 2 friends discussing the topic of marketing. Now look at questions 1 and 2.
Hi, Daniel. How are things? Have you applied for college yet?
Well, I can't decide which one to go for. Lots of colleges have sent me their glossy brochures, and I see they now go on about how environmentally friendly they are. In fact, they've got a star rating system for this one.
They're trying to attract as much interest as possible, though I'm not sure that would have much impact on my choice. Ultimately, the course has to be the right one, though I can see they need to compete.
Well, yes, but if I was torn between 2 courses, the new rating could decide it. It's good they're thinking about these issues, and the marketing people are certainly shouting about it.
It's getting like the commercial sector. Those companies who sponsor a charity, for example, are trying to persuade consumers that just by buying their products, they're doing their bit for charity and can ignore other causes. I don't know if it increases sales, but the cynic in me reckons many companies just want to appear softer in the public eye, so they make a lot of noise about their charitable credentials. Hi, Daniel. How are things? Have you applied for college yet?
Well, I can't decide which one to go for. Lots of colleges have sent me their glossy brochures, and I see they now go on about how environmentally friendly they are. In fact, they've got a star rating system for this one.
They're trying to attract as much interest as possible, though I'm not sure that would have much impact on my choice. Ultimately, the course has to be the right one, though I can see they need to compete.
Well, yes, but if I was torn between 2 courses, the new rating could decide it. It's good they're thinking about these issues, and the marketing people are certainly shouting about it.
It's getting like the commercial sector. Those companies who sponsor a charity, for example, are trying to persuade consumers that just by buying their products, they're doing their bit for charity and can ignore other causes. I don't know if it increases sales, but the cynic in me reckons many companies just want to appear softer in the public eye, so they make a lot of noise about their charitable credentials.
Extract 2. You hear 2 friends talking about ways of keeping fit. Now look at questions 3 and 4.
Are you still going to the gym, Frank?
Yes, but not as often as I should be.
That's the problem, isn't it? I've heard that the dropout rate among gym members is very high, even in those really expensive luxury health centers. Anyway, gyms aren't the answer. I'm sure the real key is to build exercise into your daily routine by doing something simple like walking to the mall or taking the stairs rather than the elevator or doing sport. And another thing, people tend to think that a 60-minute workout entitles them to laze around for the rest of the day, or eat a lot and then undo all the good they might have done. But people who exercise little and often don't fall into the same trap.
That's all very well, Mary. But what about the people who don't give up on the gym and who actually feel the benefit and quite enjoy the comradeship? Each to his own, you know. If you just give it another shot, you might find it suited you too.
Are you still going to the gym, Frank?
Yes, but not as often as I should be.
That's the problem, isn't it? I've heard that the dropout rate among gym members is very high, even in those really expensive luxury health centers. Anyway, gyms aren't the answer. I'm sure the real key is to build exercise into your daily routine by doing something simple like walking to the mall or taking the stairs rather than the elevator or doing sport. And another thing, people tend to think that a 60-minute workout entitles them to laze around for the rest of the day or eat a lot and then undo all the good they might have done. But people who exercise little and often don't fall into the same trap.
That's all very well, Mary. But what about the people who don't give up on the gym and who actually feel the benefit and quite enjoy the comradeship? Each to his own, you know. If you just give it another shot, you might find it suited you too.
Extract 3. You hear a woman telling a friend about living in her capital city as a student. Now look at questions 5 and 6.
What did you study at university, Alicia?
Horticulture, plants and things. I was based at a regional one, but I also spent time studying in the capital.
Seems a strange place to go if you want to grow things, the middle of a huge city.
That's what my fellow students said. I mean, I know it wasn't ideal. It's a harsh climate. Winters are bitterly cold and the summer's sweltering, with little rain. But folks in the city are just determined to grow stuff, on rooftops, balconies, wherever. They'll just garden anywhere they can. It was a reminder of the strong spirit of gardeners.
Come to think of it, I do remember noticing the way some of the trees were looked after there. Instead of bare bits of ground around urban trees, they seem to take great pride in filling the earth around them with flowers.
And all that's done by the residents themselves. It's as if every tree is to be celebrated.
I wouldn't go that far. Not all parts of the city are like that. What did you study at university, Alicia?
Horticulture, plants and things. I was based at a regional one, but I also spent time studying in the capital.
Seems a strange place to go if you want to grow things, the middle of a huge city.
That's what my fellow students said. I mean, I know it wasn't ideal. It's a harsh climate. Winters are bitterly cold and the summer's sweltering, with little rain. But folks in the city are just determined to grow stuff, on rooftops, balconies, wherever. They'll just garden anywhere they can. It was a reminder of the strong spirit of gardeners.
Come to think of it, I do remember noticing the way some of the trees were looked after there. Instead of bare bits of ground around urban trees, they seem to take great pride in filling the earth around them with flowers.
And all that's done by the residents themselves. It's as if every tree is to be celebrated.
I wouldn't go that far. Not all parts of the city are like that.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You'll hear a student called Josh Brady talking about visiting South Africa as part of his university course in botany. For questions 7 to 14, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds to look at part two.
Hi, everyone. My name's Josh Brady, and recently I was lucky enough to go on a botany trip to South Africa with my tutor and other students from my university to gather data for the research project we'd been involved in all year. I didn't post my diary or blog on the university website because I'd promised to submit a report on my return, which would appear there, and I was working on that from day one. We were going to explore a beautiful region of coastal countryside that had previously been affected not by drought, as is common on some parts of the African continent I've studied, but by fire. We wanted to see how the flora and other life forms there had recovered. In fact, some plants growing there are dependent on this kind of event to trigger their germination. When we first saw the landscape, however, we felt rather confused. Much of the area seemed to be cultivated fields, principally of red tea, rather than the colourful flowers we'd been led to expect. Sensing our confusion, our tutor reassured us that we'd soon be off to a wilder area where we'd see a more striking range of specimens. We'd imagined this would involve being taken around in a kind of minibus or even a van and trailer, but in fact what we boarded was what I can only describe as a safari truck, and we headed out into the natural vegetation. When we arrived and started walking through the vegetation, I found the shape of the leaves rather a surprise. Coastal plants can often be tough, with leaves coming to a point like sharp knives, but these resembled needles more than anything else. That meant I was inadequately dressed for walking through them in thin trousers. I was also totally unprepared for the amazing scent that the plants gave off. By the end of that trip, I'd lost count of how many species we'd come across. Small, delicate pink specimens, bright yellow heathers, one with deep orange blooms, the mental image of which will stay with me forever, and bright crimson wild specimens. The local farmers are totally committed to protecting the flowers and plants that have colonised the area. Conservationists call it shrubland, in other words, a vast area of vegetation that now has a rich array of plant species. But that sounds a bit negative for a place that to me seemed like a paradise. One drawback was that although the bedrooms in our hostel each had a balcony, the view was of the backyard with a small garden beyond, which was hardly impressive. But by way of compensation, the roof offered a spectacular vantage point over the surrounding scenery. We spent every evening watching the sun go down from there, a magical end to each fantastic day. Anyway, the trip was the most amazing I've ever...
Now you'll hear part two again.
Hi, everyone. My name's Josh Brady, and recently I was lucky enough to go on a botany trip to South Africa with my tutor and other students from my university to gather data for the research project we'd been involved in all year. I didn't post my diary or blog on the university website because I'd promised to submit a report on my return, which would appear there, and I was working on that from day one. We were going to explore a beautiful region of coastal countryside that had previously been affected not by drought, as is common on some parts of the African continent I've studied, but by fire. We wanted to see how the flora and other life forms there had recovered. In fact, some plants growing there are dependent on this kind of event to trigger their germination. When we first saw the landscape, however, we felt rather confused. Much of the area seemed to be cultivated fields, principally of red tea, rather than the colourful flowers we'd been led to expect. Sensing our confusion, our tutor reassured us that we'd soon be off to a wilder area where we'd see a more striking range of specimens. We'd imagined this would involve being taken around in a kind of minibus or even a van and trailer, but in fact what we boarded was what I can only describe as a safari truck, and we headed out into the natural vegetation. When we arrived and started walking through the vegetation, I found the shape of the leaves rather a surprise. Coastal plants can often be tough, with leaves coming to a point like sharp knives, but these resembled needles more than anything else. That meant I was inadequately dressed for walking through them in thin trousers. I was also totally unprepared for the amazing scent that the plants gave off. By the end of that trip, I'd lost count of how many species we'd come across. Small, delicate pink specimens, bright yellow heathers, one with deep orange blooms, the mental image of which will stay with me forever, and bright crimson wild specimens. The local farmers are totally committed to protecting the flowers and plants that have colonised the area. Conservationists call it shrubland, In other words, a vast area of vegetation that now has a rich array of plant species. But that sounds a bit negative for a place that to me seemed like a paradise. One drawback was that although the bedrooms in our hostel each had a balcony, the view was of the backyard with a small garden beyond, which was hardly impressive. But by way of compensation, the roof offered a spectacular vantage point over the surrounding scenery. We spent every evening watching the sun go down from there, a magical end to each fantastic day. Anyway, the trip was the most amazing I've ever...
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear an interview in which two journalists called Jenny Langdon and Peter Sharples are talking about their work. For questions 15 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 70 seconds to look at part three.
Today we're looking at careers in journalism. My guests are Jenny Langdon and Peter Sharples, both regular columnists on major publications. Jenny, you made your name really young, didn't you?
Relatively, yes. I was a raw recruit on the local paper when a scandal broke concerning a celebrity living nearby. Out of the blue, I found myself with a scoop on my hands. Basically, I found the guy, interviewed him, then hid him someplace where reporters on rival papers wouldn't find him. When the story broke next day, the editorial team had actually cobbled the front page story together from my notes, but it was attributed to me by name. Before I knew what was happening, I'd been headhunted by a national daily. It was a turning point, all right, but I can hardly claim it as a shrewd career move or anything.
And the editor at that national daily was a notoriously bad-tempered individual.
Well, there's no denying he deserved that reputation. I mean, having landed a dream job, I was really thrown in at the deep end. My desk was right outside his office, so I was first in the firing line if anything went wrong. Even stuff I'd had no hand in. But I knew better than to argue, and was thick-skinned enough not to take it personally. Anyway, that's what the paper was like. Always on the edge, and I really flourished in that environment.
Eventually getting your own daily column.
And that's where I really came into my own. I mean, I'd done stints on the sports desk, been celebrity correspondent, the works. Actually, I only got offered the column as a stopgap when my predecessor left under a cloud. But I was desperate to hold on to it, and it came at just the right time. If it had been earlier, I'd never have had the nerve or the experience to make it my own.
Let's bring Peter in here. You started off on the celebrity magazine called Carp, didn't you?
I did, ostensibly thanks to a speculative letter to the editor when I was still a student. Actually, I'd been doing stuff for a student newspaper all through university. Skills I learnt there stood me in good stead. When Carp magazine called me for interview, my approach to college news convinced them I was in touch with reality. You know, budgets, deadlines, all that. That's what swung it in my favour. It wasn't just having my finger on the pulse as far as youth culture was concerned, important as that was at Carp.
Can I ask you both whether you'd say courses in journalism are worth doing? Jenny?
Well, I wanted to write, and a journalism course seemed a reasonable enough starting point. Journalism is at least paid up front. unlike some forms of writing, and there's no denying that was an incentive. So, yes, I did one, and, you know, if I hadn't, who knows if I'd have been able to handle the stuff thrown at me when I first arrived at the newspaper. It does give you that grounding, but I wouldn't say it taught me everything I needed. Fortunately, a stint on the student newspaper filled in the gaps.
As is so often the case. They're often criticised for taking too strong a line on issues, but they're invaluable because they give you that free rein, and you're generally writing from the heart rather than for the money. I'd say, by all means, do a course, theorise all you like in the classroom, but just bear in mind that it's no substitute for getting out there, for developing your own style.
Now you've both recently published novels, is this a change of direction?
Oh, people keep asking that. I like to think that, much as I rate myself as a journalist and feel I have nothing left to prove, I'm still up for the next thing that comes along. I'll never be a prize-winning novelist, but having a go at it keeps me on my toes. It would be easy enough to get stale doing a column like mine, but that does remain my grand passion. I don't know about you, Peter, but I'm hardly thinking of moving on.
Well, I expect there's people who'd say we should stand aside to give up-and-coming writers a chance, but no, I'm not. I'd go along with the idea of diversification, keeping you nimble, though, and I'm not making great claims for my novel either, but I would take issue with the idea that journalism itself holds no further challenge. I wish I had your confidence, Jenny. I'm always telling myself that I'm only as good as my last piece and there's no room for complacency.
And there we must leave it. Thank you both. Coming up now...
Now you'll hear part three again.
Today we're looking at careers in journalism. My guests are Jenny Langdon and Peter Sharples, both regular columnists on major publications. Jenny, you made your name really young, didn't you?
Relatively, yes. I was a raw recruit on the local paper when a scandal broke concerning a celebrity living nearby. Out of the blue, I found myself with a scoop on my hands. Basically, I found the guy, interviewed him, then hid him someplace where reporters on rival papers wouldn't find him. When the story broke next day, the editorial team had actually cobbled the front page story together from my notes, but it was attributed to me by name. Before I knew what was happening, I'd been headhunted by a national daily. It was a turning point, all right, but I can hardly claim it as a shrewd career move or anything.
And the editor at that national daily was a notoriously bad-tempered individual.
Well, there's no denying he deserved that reputation. I mean, having landed a dream job, I was really thrown in at the deep end. My desk was right outside his office, so I was first in the firing line if anything went wrong. Even stuff I'd had no hand in. But I knew better than to argue, and was thick-skinned enough not to take it personally. Anyway, that's what the paper was like. Always on the edge, and I really flourished in that environment.
Eventually getting your own daily column.
And that's where I really came into my own. I mean, I'd done stints on the sports desk, been celebrity correspondent, the works. Actually, I only got offered the column as a stopgap when my predecessor left under a cloud. But I was desperate to hold on to it, and it came at just the right time. If it had been earlier, I'd never have had the nerve or the experience to make it my own.
Let's bring Peter in here. You started off on the celebrity magazine called Carp, didn't you?
I did, ostensibly thanks to a speculative letter to the editor when I was still a student. Actually, I'd been doing stuff for a student newspaper all through university. Skills I learnt there stood me in good stead. When Carp magazine called me for interview, my approach to college news convinced them I was in touch with reality. You know, budgets, deadlines, all that. That's what swung it in my favour. It wasn't just having my finger on the pulse as far as youth culture was concerned, important as that was at Carp.
Can I ask you both whether you'd say courses in journalism are worth doing? Jenny?
Well, I wanted to write, and a journalism course seemed a reasonable enough starting point. Journalism is at least paid up front, unlike some forms of writing, and there's no denying that was an incentive. So, yes, I did one, and, you know, if I hadn't, who knows if I'd have been able to handle the stuff thrown at me when I first arrived at the newspaper. It does give you that grounding, but I wouldn't say it taught me everything I needed. Fortunately, a stint on the student newspaper filled in the gaps.
As is so often the case. They're often criticised for taking too strong a line on issues, but they're invaluable because they give you that free rein, and you're generally writing from the heart rather than for the money. I'd say, by all means, do a course, theorise all you like in the classroom, but just bear in mind that it's no substitute for getting out there, for developing your own style.
Now you've both recently published novels, is this a change of direction?
Oh, people keep asking that. I like to think that, much as I rate myself as a journalist and feel I have nothing left to prove, I'm still up for the next thing that comes along. I'll never be a prize-winning novelist, but having a go at it keeps me on my toes. It would be easy enough to get stale doing a column like mine, but that does remain my grand passion. I don't know about you, Peter, but I'm hardly thinking of moving on.
Well, I expect there's people who'd say we should stand aside to give up-and-coming writers a chance, but no, I'm not. I'd go along with the idea of diversification, keeping you nimble, though. And I'm not making great claims for my novel either. But I would take issue with the idea that journalism itself holds no further challenge. I wish I had your confidence, Jenny. I'm always telling myself that I'm only as good as my last piece and there's no room for complacency.
And there we must leave it. Thank you both. Coming up now...
That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part four consists of two tasks. You'll hear five short extracts in which people are talking about changing their jobs. Look at task one. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H the reason each speaker gives for changing job. Now look at task two. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H what each speaker feels about their new job. While you listen, you must complete both tasks. You now have 45 seconds to look at part four. Speaker 1.
After college, I worked in a bank to make money. It's a great job if you like sitting at the same desk every day, surrounded by the same familiar faces. I got plenty of annual leave and the work itself was quite demanding. But one day I woke up and realised that it didn't amount to much and was really pretty pointless. Handing in my notice was the next logical step. I set up as a freelance photographer, a job I'd always dreamed of. After the first 6 months or so of sheer panic, I feel much calmer. This will always be a risky job, but ultimately a far more rewarding one. Not financially, mind you.
Speaker 2.
The family car sales business was the obvious and safe career route for me, even though we didn't always see eye to eye. I've no complaints about the money, but that didn't stop me looking at what other people were doing and thinking, now that's something I'd really like to get my teeth into. And that's how I got into rally driving, really. I went to rally school part-time, then got signed up by a rally team. That's when I left the motor business, not without a bit of soul-searching. I miss the family, but looking at myself now, travelling the world, maybe even having the chance to make millions living on the edge, what's not to love?
Speaker 3.
I've always worked in the music industry, but was never made to feel very welcome in the marketing department. I guess my face didn't fit, although I was doing well enough. Then, by chance, I heard a band playing in my local venue and thought they were great. I got them signed up and suddenly realised this was exactly the type of work that suited me and my abilities. Searching for talent, giving kids a start in the business I loved. So after a while, I left the company to do just that, on a freelance basis. Pay's not bad, it's possible to negotiate good percentages, but that's not why I do it.
Speaker 4.
I worked in a busy studio as a radio copywriter. It was challenging and fun, but frustrating because it wasn't leading anywhere career-wise. I was spotted by one of the radio executives. He liked my way with words and gave me the chance of a presenting slot on a general interest show. I jumped at it, but underestimated the skills involved. Without training, it's proving a steep learning curve. It would have been better to work as an intern for free for a while to learn the ropes, but it's all about seizing the moment. Too good an opportunity to miss. Now I've got a foot in the door, I'm pretty optimistic about making a go of it.
Speaker 5.
I had a responsible job that I'd worked hard for. Most people would consider being an eye surgeon pretty rewarding, both financially and emotionally. I wasn't keen to leave, but the long shifts and the sheer volume of patients got me down. I wanted to use my knowledge and experience in other ways. I did some research on the effects of sunlight on children's eyes and eventually started up my own business. We manufacture a range of sunglasses designed to protect children's eyes against harmful rays. I'm my own boss, so I call the shots, which suits me down to the ground. I have to be strict with myself about taking holidays, though.
Now you'll hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
After college, I worked in a bank to make money. It's a great job if you like sitting at the same desk every day, surrounded by the same familiar faces. I got plenty of annual leave and the work itself was quite demanding, but one day I woke up and realised that it didn't amount to much and was really pretty pointless. Handing in my notice was the next logical step. I set up as a freelance photographer, a job I'd always dreamed of. After the first 6 months or so of sheer panic, I feel much calmer. This will always be a risky job, but ultimately a far more rewarding one. Not financially, mind you.
Speaker 2.
The family car sales business was the obvious and safe career route for me, even though we didn't always see eye to eye. I'd no complaints about the money, but that didn't stop me looking at what other people were doing and thinking, now that's something I'd really like to get my teeth into. And that's how I got into rally driving, really. I went to rally school part-time, then got signed up by a rally team. That's when I left the motor business, not without a bit of soul-searching. I miss the family, but looking at myself now, travelling the world, maybe even having the chance to make millions living on the edge, what's not to love?
Speaker 3.
I've always worked in the music industry, but was never made to feel very welcome in the marketing department. I guess my face didn't fit, although I was doing well enough. Then, by chance, I heard a band playing in my local venue and thought they were great. I got them signed up and suddenly realised this was exactly the type of work that suited me and my abilities. Searching for talent, giving kids a start in the business I loved. So, after a while, I left the company to do just that, on a freelance basis. Pay's not bad, it's possible to negotiate good percentages, but that's not why I do it.
Speaker 4.
I worked in a busy studio as a radio copywriter. It was challenging and fun, but frustrating because it wasn't leading anywhere career-wise. I was spotted by one of the radio executives. He liked my way with words and gave me the chance of a presenting slot on a general interest show. I jumped at it, but underestimated the skills involved. Without training, it's proving a steep learning curve. It would have been better to work as an intern for free for a while to learn the ropes, but it's all about seizing the moment. Too good an opportunity to miss. Now I've got a foot in the door, I'm pretty optimistic about making a go of it.
Speaker 5.
I had a responsible job that I'd worked hard for. Most people would consider being an eye surgeon pretty rewarding, both financially and emotionally. I wasn't keen to leave, but the long shifts and the sheer volume of patients got me down. I wanted to use my knowledge and experience in other ways. I did some research on the effects of sunlight on children's eyes and eventually started up my own business. We manufacture a range of sunglasses designed to protect children's eyes against harmful rays. I'm my own boss, so I call the shots, which suits me down to the ground. I have to be strict with myself about taking holidays, though.
That's the end of part four. There'll now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I'll remind you when there's 1 minute left so that you're sure to finish in time. You have 1 more minute left. That's the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.